This is Digital Story Podcast number 585, May 23rd, 2017. Today's theme is The Crossover Shot. I'm Derek Story. How many times have you held back a photo because you thought it was too cliché? Or maybe it featured what we call a mature subject, such as a sunset or the Golden Gate Bridge. But maybe, just maybe, it's more artistic than you realize. And it's even possible that both photographers and the general public would admire it. That's what I call the crossover shot. And it's the first topic for today's show. So I want to start out by telling you a story that happened a few days ago at our Sonoma Coast workshop. So there we were, a bunch of seasoned photographers in really a super beautiful place. I mean, the Sonoma Coast had the rugged coastline, had the giant rocks offshore with the waves crashing against them. There were flowers. There were redwood trees. I mean, we had the whole kettle of fish, that's for sure, to work with. And one of the shoots that we did was a sunset shot. And that was a lot of fun. And so we purposely went out later in the afternoon. We delayed dinner until after we got back, and we were out in this beautiful place as the sun was setting. And of course, we all took photos. We had been shooting all day. I know I was, as I was going up the hill back to the van again, I know I was just sort of shooting all the way up the hill along the coastline. I ran one shot on Instagram. So then we fast forward to the end of the next day when we're doing our class presentation. And that's what we do at the workshops, right? We have a class presentation at the end where each photographer chooses 8 images to share with the rest of the class and discuss them. So we're going through one and then another and then another, and it's really rolling along nicely. I mean, really beautiful stuff. And we get to the end of the presentation and there hadn't been one sunset shot. And that was just like crazy. So we're talking about this. Why wasn't there at least one sunset shot? And the reason that sort of percolated up through our discussion was that, well, first of all, I've got some nice sunset stuff, but I figured everyone else would run a shot. So I didn't want to be just another run-of-the-mill sunset shot kind of guy. And then the other sentiment was, well, as beautiful as they are, they're sort of cliche, right? A sunset shot is almost like too easy. The sunset carries the shot and I just didn't feel like it was artistic enough. And as a result, we didn't see any sunset shots at all. And that gave me an opportunity to talk about what I consider the crossover shot. And what the crossover shot is that it's an image that appeals both to the general population, in other words, mom's loving eyes will like it, as well as a group of photographers. A crossover shot, a lot of times, is a popular subject. It is a sunset. It is a field of flowers. It is the Golden Gate Bridge. It is any number of those things that we're already familiar with. However, what makes it a crossover shot that takes it beyond a postcard is the artistry that the photographer uses to create that image. And that makes it special. And that makes it something that can appeal to other photographers because they can look at it and go, wow, I have never seen the Golden Gate Bridge that way. Or if I have, I didn't see it as well as you've presented it right here. And at the same time, the general population can be looking and go, wow, the Golden Gate Bridge, what a cool shot. How beautiful. That would make a nice postcard. No, we don't want them to say that because, you know, then we get all second guessing ourselves and go, wow, should I run that shot? They think it's a postcard. It's funny how we've attached, as enthusiasts and professional photographers, it's funny how we've attached that stigma to what we call the postcard shot. However, those shots that appeal to both groups, I think they're very important, and I think they're very useful, and I think, especially in this online world that we live in, and we definitely live in an online world right now, that they can help us get our images in front of more people, and increase our following and possibly increase our revenue as photographers through new jobs or through sales or through any number of things that come about from people liking your stuff. So I thought what I'd do then is provide you with five key points related to the crossover shot. And let's jump right into those right now. First of all, and I've covered this a bit in the introduction, just because it's common, that doesn't mean it's bad. You know, most of us are leery of photographing things such as sunsets, which are quite common, but that doesn't mean that you can't add your artistry to a sunset. And that's the thing that I'm always looking for, whether it's a sunset shot or anything else that is a subject that we see a lot of. And I'm thinking, what can I do with it? And a lot of times, what I can do with it is through composition. One of the things that people do that are more smartphone photographers as opposed to enthusiasts or professional photographers is that their shots tend to be more two-dimensional. In other words, they see a sunset and they shoot a sunset, right? And sometimes it's just the sunset. And you go, okay, that's a nice sunset. But as a photographer, you're not going to be very interested in that. And even the general population, they might be mildly interested in it because it is colorful, but probably not as engaged as they would be something that had more depth to it. And how do we add more depth to our shots? Well, we use foreground subjects. We use framing devices. We use activities such as people doing stuff. All those sort of things then take it from just a regular sunset shot to something that is a bit more artistic. And another, and I don't need to say this to you, but I'm going to say it anyway, just by way of reminder, is that when you're shooting a sunset shot, remember the ground or the hills or whatever is in the foreground, that's probably going to go completely black unless there's water there or something there to reflect. So don't make that half the shot. Don't make complete blackness half of your sunset shot. If you don't have anything reflecting in the foreground, or you don't have a foreground element sticking up, then move that horizon line way, 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 way down. And at least if you're going to give me a sunset shot that doesn't have anything else going on, at least let it have a low horizon. So I just have a little bit of black at the bottom and I get to enjoy the beautiful sky. Now we're using sunset for, you know, this particular example, but this could be any number of mature subjects. So bring artistry to the shot. Think about foreground subjects. Think about framing. Think about people doing stuff. Think about light painting. Think about all those sort of things. Anything that you can do to make it a little different and a little deeper. This one's related to the first one, which is just because it's difficult, that doesn't mean it's good. And we're going to go down a road right now that's basically talking about photographers being their own editors. So that's going to be the next couple points here. But as serious photographers, we have a tendency to elevate the shots that we worked really hard to get, regardless if they have appeal or not to other people. And I've talked about this before. You know, you work really hard, you hang off a cliff with one hand and you're stretched out with the other arm and the camera's dangling by a wrist strap and you manage to push the shutter to capture that shot of a bird flying by and you got the bird in the frame and you go, oh wow, that was really difficult. What are the odds of me ever doing that again? Therefore, that must be my best shot of the day. And you know what? It probably isn't. It probably isn't. So we have to learn to be disciplined enough to know that just because a shot was difficult and we worked hard to get it, that doesn't automatically elevate it to the best shot of the day, of the week, of the trip, of the assignment. It has to be looked at the same way that we look at everything else. It may end up in your select list, and it may not. And if it doesn't, that's too bad. It was too bad that you did all that work and it didn't even make the select. But you know what? That happens. Related to this, number three, we're often not the best judge of our own work. And this is the key, I think, to the crossover shot, to the successful crossover shot, where we have non-photographers look at our short list of images and comment on them, and then us listening with an open mind to what non-photographers have to say about our photographs. So let's say that you want to whittle down your list to 8 for the presentation at a workshop. And let's say that you have 20 potential shots. And you already in your mind probably have at least 6 of the 8 ready to go. You might have all 8 of the 8. But put 20 shots there and then show those 20 shots to somebody who will really look at them. I mean, this can't be a total casual thing. I mean, they have to care a little bit about your work. But someone that isn't necessarily a photographer, have them look at the shots. And then ask them, okay, what are your 3 favorites? And then it'll take them a few minutes and they'll point out their 3 favorites. And you go, really? Okay, that's great. What do you like about these shots? And then have them tell you a little bit about the shot. Now, many of the times, those 3 shots are probably not 3 shots that you were thinking about including in the final list. It's funny how often this happens. We were joking at the workshop about how often that we put a shot up on Instagram thinking that it's just going to slay, and it gets 5 likes. And then we put up something that we didn't have anything else that day, and we had this one shot, so we went ahead and put it up. And then it gets 150 likes. Go figure, right? What happened there? Well, you know, maybe when we put that shot up that we didn't overanalyze and it was more of a spontaneous image, maybe that had more life and more appeal than the shot that we analyzed to death, saying, you know what, the composition's perfect, I got rule of thirds here, the lighting's perfect, the shadows are opened up just right, you know, all that kind of stuff. The average non-photographer viewer doesn't care about those things. What the non-photographer viewer cares about is, how does that image make them feel? Are they delighted? Are they disgusted? Are they saddened? Does it make them laugh? Does it make them feel good? Does it make them want to be there? These are the kind of things that the non-photographer is thinking when they look at our work. So you have to listen to them. And if you don't have anyone look at your work and help you make the final selections, then I think you're going to fall deeper and deeper and deeper down into this ditch of overanalyzing your work and probably not showing your best stuff to the world. It remains on your hard drive while you show the stuff that probably doesn't have as much appeal. So having non-photographers review and comment on your photos really helps bring balance to our final selects, and we need to listen to these folks when they take the time to help us. Next point, consider a mix for your final choices. So if someone lobbies hard for an image that you feel isn't artistic enough, still consider including it with maybe one that you feel very strongly about. So in other words, you're going, okay, you're saying this in your brain, I really don't agree with you, with your opinion about the shot, but I also have one that I feel very strongly about, so I'm going to put yours in and I'm going to put mine in. And let's say that you do that 4 times. That gives you 8 shots. So you have 8 shots, 4 that someone else felt strongly about, 4 that you feel strongly about. Mix them all up and then let the world decide. Up the road, you will probably be very happy that you did a mix, because what's going to happen is, yes, some of your artistic shots will be popular and people will enjoy them and they will like them. So it's not like we don't have the ability to pick a good shot. I'm not saying that at all. We are going to get it right many times. But also, the delight is maybe one or two of those other shots that you wouldn't have considered stands right alongside your favorite stuff, and you would have left those out. So instead of only having 2 of the 8 that people really enjoy, maybe you have 4, maybe you have 5, and your odds go up. And then you can learn from that. You can sit back and look at those images and go, all right, now what's going on here? Why are these shots so popular? And then you can start to break them down a bit and think about them. This is really a good approach. And again, this is all part of not just hoarding our shots and being both photographer and editor, opening up that process a bit and letting other people participate. Finally, the last point that I want to make here is respect for those who achieve crossover. And this is something that I see when I'm among photographers, in that let's say someone is a very popular photographer, and we could pick any number of names right now. They have big followings on social. They get a lot of advertising gigs and all that sort of stuff. And we look at their work and we go, hey, you know what? He or she really isn't better than me. Technically speaking, you're right. Technically speaking, they're probably not better than you. However, they have figured out either intuitively, or I guess then that wouldn't be figured out, that would be just knowing, either intuitively or they have actually analyzed their stuff, a lot of what I'm talking about right now, which is not discarding stuff just because it has a common subject that happens to be artistically presented. They have figured out that shots can appeal to both the general population and to sponsors and to photographers all at the same time, and that those shots are gold. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to hang your artistic hat on those shots. What we're trying to do here, many of us, is that we're trying to gain enough recognition in our chosen craft so that we can continue to do our craft. And so shots that you present that excite people, then they will look at your other stuff. And then maybe over time, they will come to appreciate the stuff that you consider extremely artistic. So this is something, and you know, some people are going to really rail against this notion, right? I don't want to sell out as an artist, and I don't have respect for those who have sold out. Well, I don't think they've sold out. I think a lot of people that we're talking about that have popular work that is respected by multiple audiences, I think they're actually quite good. And I think that I can learn from them. And what I'm talking about right now is that I hope that you will have an open enough mind to learn from them also, including the people that you show your images to take your images to a spot that is both artistic and well-received and makes a lot of people feel good. And I think that is a great place to be. So anyway, all of that came out of our class presentation the other day at the workshop. I thought it was really interesting. I'm going to remember that no sunset shot story for a long time. We were all there. It was a beautiful sunset, and not one of us shared it with the other photographers. A remote trigger as well. So I'm going to continue talking about measuring light for flash systems with the Siconic Speedmaster L858DU handheld light meter. Now, last week we talked about high-speed sync, which is really neat. But this is more practical in the sense that, let's say you have a 2 or 3 flash setup, and you have a subject, and you just want to measure the light from the flashes falling on the subject. Well, obviously, you're going to want to stand over in the area where the subject is to measure the light. That's what makes sense. So you're standing over there with your light meter, and you're ready to go, and you go, hey, wait a minute. Who's going to trigger the flashes? So maybe you have someone else to trigger the flashes, and maybe you don't, right? Well, one of the things that you can do, and this is if you're using one of three systems, if you have a Pocket Wizard system, or an Elenchrome system, or a Photix system, you can get an optional module. It's a radio control module that actually goes right in the Speedmaster that allows radio triggering of these flash systems. And this is really handy. So then you can stand next to your subject. You press the button right there. The flashes go off, and you can take a meter reading right there next to the subject's face, a little behind the subject, a little to the side, on either way. You can get exactly the light meter reading that you want because you have a radio controlled trigger. And radio controlled triggers are fantastic because, first of all, you can use them inside or out. You can be standing just about anywhere. And unlike infrared triggers that really fall short when you're outside in bright sunlight, that doesn't bother radio controlled triggers at all. And these modules are fantastic. They just fit right inside. And so you don't have any big bulky things sticking out or any stuff like that. Now, on two of the systems, the Pocket Wizard system and the Elinchrome system, you also can control the model lights, which is pretty neat, and to some degree, the flash power control. So again, you don't have to be running back and forth from the model or the subject or wherever you're taking the reading to your units to make small changes. So you're standing there, you take a reading, and you go, just a little too much juice. You can actually adjust the power control right there without having to go back over to the flashes. This is really nice. Now, all three systems allow for zone control, so you can set up zones that prevent your flashes from accidentally being triggered by other units, which is kind of nice. Now, if you don't use those systems, and let's say that you use the, I won't call it old-fashioned wired system, but you know what I mean. It is old-fashioned, all right. But hey, I use it sometimes too. There's actually a PC terminal connector on the Speedmaster so that you can trigger the flashes semi-remotely that way, as long as you have a cord long enough. And if you don't want to mess with any of that, there's a tripod socket in the bottom of the unit so you can set it up and you can put your Siconic anywhere that you want. So if you want to learn more about the Siconic Speedmaster L858DU handheld light meter, click on the link in the show notes, or we have a tile that runs on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can click on that. You can learn about high-speed sync. You can learn about incident light metering. You can learn about using these optional modules. You can learn the details of what each module provides for you in terms of working with Pocket Wizard or the other systems. All that information is there. This is really a professional tool. It's highly accurate, and it can save you a lot of time and a fair amount of headache. And how much does it matter that you seem cool, calm, and in control of your lighting when you're on a shoot? This Speedmaster can help you with all of that. More stupid photographer moves. Many of us had a lot of fun with last week's show, and as promised, I posted the link to the show on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thedigitalstory. And a lot of folks commented, and they added their own stupid photographer moves, which I absolutely loved. So I thought what I would do is that I would just share some of these with you right now. They made me smile, and I think they'll probably make you smile too, at least some of them. All right, so here we go. I'm just going to read the name, and I'm going to read what they wrote. Mark, yep, I've done the went out with a spare discharge battery. And I can add one formatted the wrong card. Fortunately, without erasing any good images that mattered. Yes, I forgot all about formatted the wrong card, but that does happen. That does happen indeed. Just remember, you know, since we're speaking of this, that if you do accidentally format a card that has images on it that you want to keep, that you haven't put on your computer yet, just stop shooting with it right away. Don't add any more images, and then you can use software to recover. Because what happens is the images aren't erased right away. They're just hidden. But as you continue using the card, they get bumped off. So just stop shooting with that particular card and then get the to software recovery as quickly as possible so you can get those images back. So thank you, Mark. Carl, realizing halfway through a shoot that the only memory card I have is nearly full because I failed to format it. Now that I think about it, that is two stupid mistakes. This is one that I do. This one could actually be on my list because I use my memory card as a backup once I offload the images onto the computer. And I don't format that memory card until I've backed up the images that are on my computer. So when there's two copies of the library or whatever it happens to be, catalog, when there are two copies electronically, let's say on my computer and then on an external hard drive, then I'll format the card. Where I get myself in trouble is that I've been shooting, I've offloaded the images, they're only on the computer. I haven't backed them up yet. And then I'm out in the field with that memory card, and then I have to go, what am I going to do? Am I going to roll the dice and erase these images, format the card out here in the field so I can start shooting again, knowing then that I only have images in one place? That makes me very nervous. I don't like that, and I try to avoid it at all costs. Richard, I often leave the house with just a camera and lens and no memory card. So then I'm just carrying jewelry. So this is, it's funny how many memory card related stupid photographer moves we have here. So this is for those of us who take our memory cards out of our cameras and put them in a memory card reader, and then forget to put the card back in the camera when we're finished. And then to really add to the illusion, when we take the memory card out of the camera, then we actually close the door on the camera. Don't do that. Leave the door open on the camera until you put the memory card back in. That may at least help your cause a bit, so that you're carrying jewelry less often and photographic equipment more often. Thank you, Richard, for that. Rob, my dough moments. Camera still in bracketing mode from the day before, and I wonder, what is wonky with my exposures? This I have seen before. I have actually had famous people approach me saying, hey, I'm writing a review on this camera and the exposures are all over the place. Will you take a look at it? Is it me or is it the camera? And it was this exact problem. The camera was in bracketing mode, so they were getting underexposure, overexposure, normal exposure. So they're getting this checkerboard of exposures and not being able to figure out what is going on here. Now, sort of a related version of this is to leave your camera in spot metering mode. Ooh, that's a good one too, right? And in a way, even more pernicious, because this one, at some point, you're looking at your image and you go, bracketing is on. But spot metering is a little bit more slippery. And your exposures are going to be sometimes dark, sometimes light, because it depends on where that little spot is measuring in the frame. So leaving your camera in spot metering mode can be very embarrassing. Remember to move it back to patterned metering mode if you do use the spot meter. Thank you, Rob, for reminding us of that exposure nightmare. Jim, I routinely found myself with a bag of discharged batteries. Now, when I charge a battery, I wrap an elastic band around it. Now, the discharged ones are easily identified. It also has a side benefit that it prevents anything in the camera bag from shorting the terminals. And, you know, that's actually quite a good tip, because whether you use rubber bands or some other system, and a lot of photographers have some sort of system to indicate which batteries are discharged and which ones are fully charged. The only thing that can really get you on this is that if you have a system and you're relying on that system, then you have to execute that system, right? You can't do this just some of the time, or you're going to end up at the Lincoln Memorial with dead batteries, all righty? So great tip, Jim, but you got to do it all the time or it'll still get you. And then Jerry, and this one's from our recent workshop. So we were talking about stupid photographer moves. And one morning we were outside getting ready for a morning shoot. And Jerry was one of our participants. And he's one of our veterans. He's been at a lot of workshops. And he's a terrific shooter. So he was sort of smiling sheepishly. He said, yeah, I put my batteries in their chargers. And then I plugged up chargers into the power strip before I went to bed last night. Problem was, the switch on the power strip was off. So I was thinking, as I slept soundly, that all my batteries were charging, and instead, I woke up getting ready for an exciting day of workshop shooting with a batch of dead batteries. So, yeah. And this is the thing about photography. If there are 10 things that need to be done, and you only do 9 of them, you're going to get screwed. And unfortunately, Jerry did everything but make sure that switch was on his power strip. Through the help of others And through some timely breaks, he did get through the day and he shot wonderfully. So those are some additional stupid photographer moves contributed by our wonderful TDS audience of crack photographers. And all of us now should feel just a little less embarrassed about the stupid moves that we make. All right, guys, thanks so much for sharing, and onward and upward. We may revisit this topic a few months up the road. Capture One Pro users, I have not one, but two new trainings for you. So I was working on both of these trainings about the same time. So naturally, they are released about the same time. And they're released both with lynda.com and LinkedIn Learning. So depending on which of those sites you use for your training, they'll be in both places. And the first one is Capture One Pro 10. Essential training. And for that one, what I've done is I've provided more of an overview of Capture One Pro 10, including the new features with that release. And what I wanted to do is, since, yes, Capture One Pro 10 has some differences, it has some cool stuff. It has three-step sharpening. It has output proofing. It has some interface changes. It has some really nice stuff. But it's not dramatically different than Capture One Pro 9. So I didn't want to repeat everything that I did in Capture One Pro 9 because a lot of that stuff didn't change. So that gave me the opportunity to make Capture One Pro 10 essential training a different thing, where I got to include, let's say, more localized brushing, where I got to include some of the techniques that, let's say, that I've been using more over the last year that I wasn't using as much when I did Capture One Pro 9, because I'm using it for my professional work, so I'm getting better with it and I'm learning new things all the time. So the Capture One Pro 10 title complements the Capture One Pro 9 title, and really together they give you a very nice essential training on this application. Now, there is a few things that overlap because there are some things that you just want in both titles. But I tell you, the way that the Lynda titles are set up is that you can pick and choose the movies that you want to watch. So if you're new to Capture One Pro, I would watch both the 9 training and the 10 training. If you've been using it for a while and you feel pretty comfortable with it, then you can watch just the 10 training to pick up the new things, both in terms of features, but also in terms of techniques. Now, alongside this, one of the things that we've learned at LinkedIn and Lynda is that commercial outfits, graphic departments, are using our trainings, our Capture One trainings, for their staff. And so we wanted to create a training for those folks. And so we created our second in the series of advanced techniques. Now, the first advanced techniques training that's already been out is in library management, because I just feel like that's the place that you want to start, where you really want to drill down into library management. That's out there right now. And if you haven't really got your head around library management with Capture One Pro, then I think you would really enjoy that title. But the new one that just released is the advanced techniques for image retouching. And in this, I really get to dig into removing or downplaying offending color, using the brushes, using the gradient screens, you know, doing all that kind of stuff, you know, working on just one tone in the image to either make it brighter or bring it down a bit. So for those that really enjoy image editing with Capture One Pro, then this new advanced techniques, this retouching title that just came out a week ago, I think you're really going to like. Two new things for those that want to keep learning and getting better with Capture One Pro 10. We have the advanced techniques and retouching, and we have the essential training for 10. And I'm already working on the 10.1 new features, and we're going to be on top of that here really soon. And hopefully it won't be too long before that comes out also, and that will complement the existing Capture One Pro 10 essential training. If you are a Capture One Pro user, I hope you go over and take a look at both the advanced techniques and the essential training for Capture One Pro 10. They're a lot of fun, and I'm pretty sure that you'll pick up a few tips that you didn't know before. I want to remind you that reserve list members for the Ottoman Wine Country Photography Workshop, you should have your invite. If you don't, make sure you write me. We're adding people all the time. And then I have a couple folks that say, hey, make sure that you send me that again because I want to sign up. So seats are going to be limited here real soon if you're interested in that workshop. And, you know, this is a workshop where we're trying something new. This is a workshop where we are creating content for the photographers, content where you really get out and get to take some good shots and do some good photography work and have the lab time together and do the presentation, all the stuff that I think is really important in our photography workshops. But the travel companions also have lots to do, so they don't have to be bored or just, you know, hanging around the hotel pool all day. They too can join us for some of the meals, the wine tasting. Really, a good half of the workshop, the travel companions can join us. This is something that I've never really built into a workshop before. I think it's kind of neat. I think it's even a little innovative. And if you have a travel partner that's interested both in Sonoma County beauty and in learning more about wine and wine tasting and all that kind of stuff, you might want to take a look at this workshop. Of course, it's outlined on the TDS workshops page. And if you're not on the reserve list, you can use the send me info form to receive an invite. Big thanks to all of our Patreon members for helping me really create a budget for this podcast. It was very interesting. I think at the last workshop that we just did, I think we had 4 Patreon members there. It was really great. So I got to thank them personally, which felt really good. Again, what I told them is what I'm going to tell you right now. This allows me to run this podcast like a predictable business, and I don't have to worry as much about the ups and downs of affiliate money or sponsorships or all that. I know I have a certain amount of money to come in to pay the bills, to pay the admin, to pay the server, all that sort of stuff. And it's you guys and gals that are keeping the lights on. Thank you so much. And last but not least, a big thanks to the folks over at Red River Paper. Someone asked me at the workshop, how long has Red River Paper been a sponsor of this podcast? And I said, you know what? I think they came in the 2nd year. And I didn't look it up, but I started this podcast in late 2005. I think they were in either early 2007 or late 2006. They've been with us that long. Tremendous sponsors. Really stand behind the show. They have a tile on all the pages of Digital Story, and they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/Red River Paper. Okay, that's going to do it for me this week. I hope you'll come back and join me again next week. Bye bye now.